Who's there?
Hello, Kilov.
Axel! Why must you follow me?
I follow you because I want to make you famous. I want to cut off your head and put it in a museum. You want to be famous, don't you?
No!
I'm coming for you, Kilov.
No! Oh, not real. Oh, just a dream. But wait. What if Ted Roxton really is following me? If this is true, what can I do? I can't spare a platoon. But there's nothing else that... Oh, of course. Chrome.
Chrome, the killing machine who had single-handedly disposed of 10 guards at the Idaho missile base from which the missiles were taken. He was the one. He owed Kilov something. His life. The life Roxon had taken from him. The life Kilov's scientists had brilliantly restored. An experiment in cyborg creation that had partially succeeded. Chrome was too dangerous, too unpredictable to have along anymore. Chrome was so menacing, so fearful-looking, that even Kilov was afraid to see him alone. For the man had no real features, or head for that matter. He had been an SS commando in von Reisling's Nazi army. And when von Reisling had died, the special commando unit had become Kilov's to command, if he could. Kilov had used him well, pitting Chrome against many. He had been blown apart by a howitzer fired by Roxon during the Battle of Forrester Valley. An experimental operation had been performed. An operation that put together the mutilated pieces of Commando Gunter to create Chrome. Science had fashioned a new face and skull out of chrome steel, shiny and impenetrable, to encase his brain and mouth and throat. He didn't talk much, but he still took orders. For now. Kilov sat there on the edge of his bed for a long time, feeling the gentle roll of the trailer over the ice and snow before he decided Chrome would be a one-man patrol 100 miles behind. He'd be given enough food and ammo to keep alive, if he could hunt up a meal now and then. The other soldiers didn't like him around anyway. He was a born killer, devoid of any comradely instincts. He would sit perfectly still and just watch them all play cards or talk, his unblinking, reconstructed eyes following any movement around the area. It would be a morale booster to be rid of him. A half hour later, the metal man stood before Kilov's desk.
What are my orders, Master?
Chrome, your mission is to drop back behind us and intercept and destroy any pursuers. I don't expect any pursuers, but I've learned never to underestimate the free fighters. You are to plant booby traps, mines. I suggest that there are several places behind us, unstable rock formations, glacial buildups, that could be rigged with small explosive charges. They should be set to go off if someone passes below.
It will be done. I have longed for the opportunity to leave the emotional rabble you call your troops behind. They complain and worry. I do neither. It is my pleasure to seek out the enemies of the Soviet state for you, Kilov. The world Soviet must not be ruled by weaklings. I have anticipated your order, and have modified the Dragunov 2 sniper rifle for greater power. I will carry that and the explosive with me. I will range far and wide behind you, seeking out and destroying any who follow. As you know, I am impervious to cold. I will function. When shall I return?
When those who follow me are destroyed, keep them from me. I order you to do this, for I believe in your power. Fulfill your destiny. Kill.
Yes, I accept the order of my superior.
Equipment was prepared for him, and with his long-range Dragunov sniper rifle and infrared scope, explosives, climbing rope, and skis, he was sent off. Kilov was relieved when he was gone. He didn't like the way the man's yellow synth-steel eyes stared at him, nor the way his hands kept clenching in immense steel fists.
Let someone follow me now. Let them come up upon Chrome and try to reason with the metal-faced stranger. Let them plead with him.
Ah!
Oh, where is that Arthroville?
Oh, much better. Soon we will reach the Arctic Circle, and all these worries will fade away.
Tinglum passed Roxen the steaming cup of Eskimo tea. They were cold but thawing out, sitting Indian style around the small fire made from dry lichen. Tinglum's crude map was on his lap.
That V is a mountain called Mount Drakehome. The X is my village. So we've made good time. Judging from our speed and the number of hours we've traveled, we're about a third of the way to the mountain.
It looks like we're near a river.
Yes. The line is the Draco River, which flows directly from Mount Draco's glacier. Where the two connect is the danger.
What do you mean?
Well, periodically the glacier surges, advancing without warning. When a glacier decides to move, it moves. The last time it surged, it crossed the Draco River Valley and blocked the river, forming a lake. The next time it surges, it could wash out the ice dam. The resulting floods would be awesome.
Why can't we cross the glacier itself, above the breaking point?
Because the hills would be too steep for the dogs. Just below the breaking point, a surge shattered the ice into a hellish landscape. It would be like ants trying to cross the Himalayas. We'd never get the sleds and dogs across. The way directly north is blocked by the highest mountains in the Yukon Range. Our only hope is to follow the river, which should be frozen solid. Once across, we'll be about a day's journey from the Sasquatch Forest, noted by the Y's on the map. And beyond that is Ice City.
Ice City is the X behind the trees.
Yes.
What's past it? Why is the map blank?
The area beyond the forest on the other side of Ice City is blank because I do not know what is there. There is a legend that evil spirits guard the place, and that it is a no-man's land from which none return.
I see. You did say the Sasquatch would be hibernating, right?
I don't think we'll have to worry about them. They usually begin hibernation about this time. But I can't guarantee that. The aurora seems to enrage them. It keeps them awake. And there's been a lot of it, as you have seen lately.
Yes. But that same aurora will help us see our way when the moon is below the horizon.
One more thing. I didn't want to tell you before, but now I have to. If the Draco River is frozen solid, we can just glide across. But there are geysers of hot water underneath that are just as unpredictable as the glacial surges. It can cause monstrous crevices or thin ice areas. From now on, you'll have to pay close attention to the surface side when we ride. The crevices can come up very suddenly. It is not something that should be approached in darkness.
A blanket of snow was beginning to fall as the party remounted their sleds. A cold wind from the Arctic North blew right in their faces as the dogs started forward once again. The soft, powdery substance accumulated quickly, making the sleds drag, impeding the movement of the dogs. Rock knew that this was only the beginning of things to come. Further north, the weather would be even more fickle. This flurry could become a blizzard, and with a constant wind, could make snowdrifts high enough to bury them forever. The outline of the mountain grew larger. Low-slung clouds masked its full height with tendrils of wispy fog. Then Mount Draco's peak became visible above the twisting veils. It was as if the mountain was a thing alive, breathing. That mountain was going to try to take a life. Rock was sure of it. The wind picked up and seemed to penetrate Roxen's bones despite the warm clothing. The snow made it ever more difficult to make out Tinglum's sled over the tails of his dogs. The brief day dawned for an hour and then was gone. The snow blinded Roxen, stinging his face. It seemed to penetrate even the superfine stitching of his gear and attack him. It grew more difficult to breathe the icy air. Rock momentarily looked back to see how the other sleds were doing, but he could see no further than about 15 feet behind him. And when he turned his head forward, Tinglum had vanished into the wall of white. Roxanne strained his eyes to find the Nara, but he had disappeared into the blinding snow. Rock barely made out something lying directly in his path. It was like a lake of pure black. He was within feet of it when he realized with horror what it was.
Whoa! Stop!
He was standing on the edge of a chasm. He was within inches of a yawning, black, bottomless abyss. The chasm was broad enough and deep enough to comfortably swallow the entire expeditionary force and have plenty of room for more.
Thank God you stopped! My damn lead dog went after something to the right. It only took a second to separate me from the rest of you. Up here, disaster, death is always just a second away. We must now proceed with utmost caution. Where there is one crevasse, there are others. It is imperative that each of you follow in single file, directly in my tracks.
Tinglum started skiing parallel to the crevasse in front of his sled. Using a staff, he kept poking through the snow to see if there was solid ground underfoot. The dogs perked up their ears and took care that each paw hit solid ground. But fearing the loss of a dog, they were unharnessed. Humans became the muscle power to move the vehicles. The dogs, reined together, trailed, watching. After a mile or so, the miserably cold men came to the end of the crevasse and could continue on their way. But then, they came upon a veritable field of smaller cracks, many hidden under the most recent snow. A jammed skid could destroy a sled, but the loads were toward the middle of the sleds. Again and again, they were able to tip the front end of a sled up in the air until it was once again over solid ground. As the sled spanned a crack, the driver would leap across the crevasse and pull it on. This all made tough work. Yards felt like miles. The temperature dropped to minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit, made even colder by the lack of sun and by the howling wind. The field of cracks finally ended. The dogs were rehitched, none lost. But then came another obstacle to defeat. Snow, driven against scattered boulders, began to form into drifts around them, making the going even tougher than before. The wind drove the snow like a hurricane of knife blades into their faces, cutting the skin, the blood freezing as it oozed out. Their nostrils seemed glued together by the cold, making breathing almost impossible. Robinson's red beard was now covered with ice. Archer looked like he had a bib of cotton. Their feet began growing numb, and their hands frostbitten, despite the caribou hide mittens. Secretly, each man half hoped that Roxanne would tell them to turn back, or at least tell them to camp down for the storm. Then they would crawl exhausted into their tents and into their fur sleeping pellets, at least to find shelter from the wind. At last, the Doomsday Warrior's hand went up.
We'll make camp here.
The howling snowstorm was now a full-fledged blizzard. Roxanne knew that it would be impossible to go on now, or even to pitch tents in this wind.
This is a goddamn blizzard, Roxanne. How are we supposed to hunker down?
I know, Robinson. Tinglum, how long does a blow like this last?
A day. Maybe two. It is imperative to construct a shelter. We must begin by digging a pit.
Dig a pit?
Yes. Should I give the order?
No. All right, men. We're gonna start digging. Tinglum is going to coordinate.
All hands removed the shovels from the sleds, gathered in one corner of the snowbank, and began to dig. The snow was piling up almost faster than they could shovel. Still, they kept shoveling. Within half an hour, four of the men could fit inside. It took another half hour for the rest. Tinglum directed the piling up of snow blocks cut with knives to be passed upward from the interior. The dogs huddled together like a single ball of fur in the snow to keep from freezing. Somehow, the man built a crude but functional igloo.
Good job! Now everybody inside! Let me just start this up. Ah, one whale oil heater, ready to go.
I'm gonna make us some coffee and dinner over the fire.
There are extra lamps. I will use them to melt water for the coffee.
So what's for dinner, monsieur?
Rabbit legs and pea soup. That ersatz coffee will be ready in a few minutes, as soon as the ice has melted and boiled.
Roxanne, would you care for a game of chess?
Why not? Nothing else to do right now.
Okay. Do you want to play white or red?
White. I'm gonna need all the advantage I can get.
Okay. Let me show you the perk defense.
It was 24 hours before they could again venture out. With the blizzard having moved on, the temperature got to a comfortable 0 degrees Fahrenheit. They made excellent speed, and they reached the Draco River within 7 hours. They started making their way up it, as the ice was a good 6 inches thick. They sped along like they were being pursued by the devil himself, not quite positive the ice river was going to hold them up, and wanting to get off it as soon as possible. The river at this position headed almost directly north, parallel to the Alcan Highway, and they were making up precious time, moving 30 or 40 miles in a matter of hours.
How much longer until we're through the river?
It shouldn't be much more than an hour.
Well, that's good, because... Shit!
Rock saw the first two dogs and his team sink into their haunches through the cracked ice. Steam rose.
That's an underground hot spring! That water's boiling, Roxanne!
The dogs! They're falling in! Tingle them! I can't get to them! Whoa!
Everybody, it's a localized spring! You're in little danger, but bring your sledge to the ground. Throw rope to Roxanne from the rear and help pull the lead dogs out of the water.
Hurry up! Another two huskies fell in.
Help's coming! Catch!
Got it! I'm tying it to the sled.
Good. Here's another one.
It's tied. Pull us out, now!
Pull, you bastards! Pull!
The last two dogs of the six-dog team somehow managed to get out of the water with the sled. They shook and shivered off the most water they could. Behind them, however, Roxanne saw a dog stop swimming and go under. In a moment, he came up to the surface, belly up dead. Then the lead gave out and went limp. He realized there was no saving the first two dogs. They had become weights.
I'm sorry, fellas.
Let him do it! Another pull!
As the sled moved backward, Rock pulled on the reins of the middle two huskies. They emerged from the water, their fur plastered against their bodies.
Yes! We're all out, guys!
And pull!
Without the weight in the water, the sled moved easily across the ice. Roxanne carefully guided the four shivering huskies to the riverbank.
Roxanne, are you all right?
Yeah. It's just good to feel solid ground again.
They had to stop for nearly an hour. Rock dried his boots over a fire. The huskies were rubbed dry and reattached to their harness. Some of the supplies from his sled were moved to the others, since he was short two dogs now. Though the men were reeling from the close call, Roxanne insisted they push on. As he sat, staring into the fire, Roxanne felt immensely tired. They were in the middle of an absolutely flat whiteness that dropped off like the ends of the earth in all directions, never ending. No respite, no change, just a constant, hostile nothingness. He tried to shake a growing, brooding melancholy, but couldn't. They set out once again, staying to one side of the river until Tinglin deemed it safe to cross. Rock's new right lead dog took over instinctively as the driver of the others. At last they came to a valley between two hills, the first hills made of Mother Earth, or at least frozen tundra that they had seen for days. There were even trees, short, squat evergreens.
The Ice City lies just a few miles more, Roxanne. Just on the other side of the Sasquatch Forest.
Where they're hibernating.
I hope so. The Aurora has been very lively.
And that angers them.
Yes. We had best keep our guard up.
Roxanne and his men camped in a sheltered valley where they would be protected from the buffeting wind and driving snow just outside the Sasquatch Forest. Roxanne and Tinglem took inventory of their supplies and came back with bad news.
Everybody seated? All the tenting and hunting equipment is sound, and we've got plenty of fuel for the portable stoves. But we've used up the last of the food.
The tired men hardly looked interested.
Well, men, do I have any volunteers for a hunting party?
I can hunt, Roxanne.
No. You've been working hard this whole trip, Tinglem. I can tell you're exhausted. There must be men who are up to it more.
That is fair. At least game is plentiful in this area. We can drink tea until our hunters return.
Anybody else want to volunteer?
I'll go, Roxon. Once I put the pot on the fire, there's nothing else for me to do around here.
Robinson stood up, his red beard frosted with icicles.
He's gonna need a man along who knows what he's doing. I'm a mountaineer, you know.
I know. That's why I chose you for this mission. Hopefully, if we come across any foreign tribes, I'll get to use your knowledge.
Until that day, I'll just settle for helping feed you guys.
Good. Well, that settles it. You and McCaughlin will be our hunting party. Synchronize your watches. I want you two back in 6 hours, whether you've bagged any game for the pot or not. The rest of you men can use this time to catch up on sleep.
McCaughlin and Robbins had checked out the dogs in no time and loaded the sleds with hunting gear and rifles. The dogs, feeling the lightness of the load, were frisky and energetic. Soon the camp vanished from view as the hunters approached the forest. The scattered, short, squat evergreens became very abundant as McCaughlin and Robinson rode. The height of the trees increased. They rode in for a half hour.
All right, this should be good. I think I see something already.
Yeah?
Yeah. Hare tracks. Over there are fox tracks, hot on their trail. I propose we follow them wherever they take us in the forest. We can arrange a chain of loop-line traps on the hare's route of travel. That way we might snare the hare or the fox.
Well, I suppose you know what you're doing, but this terrain already gives me the creeps. There's something sick-looking about this forest. I propose we travel for an hour more, and then, no matter what happens, stop. We can check and collect the traps on our way back.
Sounds good.
Thus setting the traps and loops at frequent intervals, they traveled deeper still into the brooding forest. Though the place made McCaughlin uneasy, he was glad he had come along. Robinson did know what he was doing, and McCaughlin was learning a lot. Robinson quickly laid 8 traps. At the end of an hour, they turned back to hopefully collect their catch.
This one's empty.
And this one too. But wait. All right. We bagged a fox, Robinson.
Hey, all right.
We're gonna be eating well tonight. You know, I can't get rid of this feeling of being watched. It sounds silly.
Huh? McCaughlin!
Get off me, around!
McCaughlin!
Roxon lay silent. He tried to meditate, to bring himself to the innermost recesses of his mind. But he couldn't. He was distracted by the eerie-sounding Arctic wind and by the crushing nothingness that already surrounded him. He noticed a light playing on the tent and opened his eyes. It was just the northern lights. He struggled to return to an unremembered dream. He tried to channel his thoughts in the direction of Rona and Kim. Pleasant thoughts, but his mind kept coming back to the deteriorating condition of his men. All had sore, strained, tired muscles, and backs stiff from having to stay in one position so long on the sleds. Farrell's and Detroit's hands and feet were covered with chilblains and some frostbite. All had faces burned by the constant icy wind. Their noses were peeling, and their faces were cracked with cold. Peterson had had a trembling fit and suffered from shortness of breath. Tinglum's salves, ointments, and medicines had been invaluable under the grueling circumstances and had provided relief. But they were all close to cracking, Rock could tell. Rock checked his chronometer. 7 hours had passed since the hunting party had left camp. Rock was worried. What had become of them? He found Tinglum outside, staring at the sky.
I don't like the look of that.
The northern lights?
Yes. The patterns are the sort that wake of the Sasquatch. Even the dogs are affected.
Roxon turned to the huddled dogs, saw their wide-eyed look and laid-back ears. They were uneasy, all right.
The hunting party was due back an hour ago. I think we should go after them, now.
Shortly thereafter, a party composed of Tinglum, Archer, Roxon, Peterson, and Chen headed out over the snow. Detroit and Sharansky were left to watch camp. The Aurora Borealis raged across the sky. A feeling of dread anxiety filled the men who rode into the night. This hypnotic life was the source of irrationality, something that challenged their rational minds, threatening insanity. It was with profound relief that they came under cover of the deep forest. It wasn't long before Tinglum discovered the hunting party's tracks and the traps. In less than an hour, the heavy drag marks in the snow were discovered also. They followed these for about a half mile. Soon, in the distance, could be seen a glow that seemed to be emanating from the mouth of a cave. Rock and his men dismounted their sleds to investigate on foot. They climbed a small hill of loose scree, and hidden by a copse of trees, watched shadows cross the light in the cave opening. Roxen motioned to his men to go inside. With their flashlights lit, they advanced through the mouth of the cave.
You'll have to be very careful. Avoid the stalactites and stalagmites. Some of them look damn sharp.
It was like an obstacle course. The cave narrowed down and forced them to go single file. Jen spotted a bit of rag from McCaughlin's jacket on one of the sharp green stalactites. The cave narrowed more, and the ceiling lowered. They found themselves crouching. Deep inside the winding cave, Rock was the first to notice something peculiar. A smell. Foul. Musky. The dogs had sort of a musky scent, which he had grown used to. But this was a putrid odor that now assaulted his olfactory sense. Something like rancid human perspiration, or a thousand sweat socks moldering in gym lockers that had just been opened after 100 years of sitting idle.
That is Sasquatch smell.
Rock led the way as they climbed down into another narrow passageway. From time to time, they doused their lights to follow the flickering glow. This new tunnel was not limestone like the other passageways, but seemed carved out of dark rock. Trickles of muddy runoff water ran through the pebbly brown dirt underfoot. They were deep under the mountain now, perhaps a quarter mile in, and still descending. The steep, pebbly ground slowed their progress and didn't do their attempt at being quiet any good. They were almost at their goal. The glow ahead was bright enough to light their way, so Roxen motioned for them to flick off their flashlights. Slowly, cautiously, Roxen and his team progressed toward that orange light ahead and the source of the scream. The floor of the cave grew smoother, as if worn by the tread of many feet. The ceiling heightened to 9 feet or more, and the horrid smell grew overwhelmingly strong. Roxen stopped near a ledge. They were 20 feet above the floor of a high, dome-ceilinged circular chamber. As they knelt down to keep out of sight, their eyes beheld a gruesome scene. Robinson, or rather what was left of him, was being roasted on a spit by immense red-haired creatures that resembled orangutans. 5 pointy-headed Sasquatch were waiting to taste the flesh of their roasted victim.
It must have been Robinson's scream.
Against the far wall of the chamber lay McCaughlin, bound and gagged, a look of horror on his face as he waited his turn on the barbecue spit. Their big friend had to be rescued, now. But to do that, the rescuers would have to do battle. There was no way to get to McCaughlin except through the whole mess of eaters, and the red-furred, pointy-headed things wouldn't like that at all. Rock sized up his opponents. He could see them clearly in the light of the cooking fire. They were sitting on their haunches, yet even in this position they were as tall as a man.
They must be 9 feet tall, if an inch.
Yeah, and each one of them must weigh 400 pounds. With a star knife or two, might cut them down to size, if I can just hit the right place.
You do that, Chen, but don't try it from here. So busy eating, you might be able to get closer. Close enough to use our shot pistols and your star knives. The closer we get before they spot us, the more likely it is they won't get a chance to slaughter McCaughlin.
With Roxen in the lead, the men moved along the ledge until they found sufficient roughness to the 20 feet of rock face below to afford them footholds. They descended, quite out in the open. Should any of the Sasquatch have turned from their grim repast, they would have seen them. But the monsters were too busy eating. Rock and his men spread out fast and held up 3 fingers. 2, 1.
Rapid fire! Aim for their chest!
The creatures went for crude pikes and axes. Rock was confronted by the biggest of the bunch.
Hold on, McCoughlin, we're coming!
You're not going anywhere, Rock!
Angry we interrupted your meal? An exploding star knife will take care of that!
Good shot, Chen!
Thank you. There's still five left!
Yeah! There's two above us! Shit! Random spray!
Rock shot from concealment to get a better shot. 20 feet above him, he spotted a grinning Sasquatch, boulder in hand. But before Rock could target it, Tingram had thrown his harpoon straight into the creature's chest. Another opponent jumped down. Roxon stood his ground and stared into the red, veiny eyes. And the creature stared back. Rock backed up, having dodged the Sasquatch's charge and delivered a few blows of his own. The giant creature stood and stared at Roxon, its red, wide-slitted eyes filled with flames of anger. A black tongue, thick as a man's wrist, darted in and out of the open jaw. It rested back down on its haunches, preparing what Roxon could see was a new leap. Without turning, Rock sensed the presence of another, a human to his right side.
Move real slow, Jen. This thing's looking dinner right in the eye. I don't think it's gonna watch you too hard. Circle to the left.
I'll take a shot at it.
Not yet. Wait for my signal.
Chen moved almost imperceptibly to the side, out of the direct striking range of the thing. The red eyes continued burning into Roxon, letting Chen get in position for what would surely be a killing blow. But as he lifted the star knife, the Sasquatch grew impatient and leapt.
Chen, now!
Chen's star knife flew directly into the thing's bowels.
Chen, you take the right. I'll try and...
From behind the three monsters came a black form with a fire, Archer with a flaming arrow. The Sasquatch ran back and forth in a futile effort to put itself out, but there was no stopping the fire. Archer removed a second self-igniting steel arrow from the quiver on his back and notched it onto his taut crossbow string, but one of the two remaining creatures rushed straight for him, swinging a huge axe. Archer slid to the floor, gurgling up a red paste. The axe stayed embedded in his hair-matted skull, his eyes rolled upward.
Archer!
Shit!
Rock drew his hunting knife as the last remaining Sasquatch turned to him. The monster leapt forward like a meteor, impossible to track. Rock squirmed out from under the creature just in time to see the axe fly towards him. But it whipped the axe in an arc, striking backhand at Rock. Rock almost fell unconscious from the staggering blow. His eyes were spinning around in his head like balls on a roulette wheel, and he could feel a stream of blood flowing down his neck. He blinked, trying to regain his vision. He couldn't go under, not with that hairy man-beast coming at him.
I got it, Rock!
Chen's flying kick hit the wrist holding the axe. Rock immediately went for it. Holding it in both hands, Rock swung down at the Sasquatch's head with every ounce of strength he possessed. Its eyes flew out in a gush of yellow fluid as it fell to its knees. Pieces of bone and flesh scattered all over the killing field. Its head was split in two. Rock's lungs hurt more than his body. The pain of sucking in the icy air was now the dictator of his numb world. The Doomsday Warrior tried to stay on his feet and started walking toward the blood-soaked figure of Archer. His vision clouded. He felt the throbbing pain in his skull from the axe blow turn into a hammering whirlpool of blackness. And he fell into it. Rock awoke several hours later and realized he was moving. The pale Arctic sun on the horizon let him see that he was on the sled again, this time lying under a mound of blankets and pelts. McCoughlin was driving.
Oh,
where?
Europe. We are through the woods and on our way to Ice City. As far as we can tell, you're in one piece. You might want to move around a bit to see if any bones are broken. You took quite a blow, but you'll live. Thanks for the rescue, buddy.
I'm a little sore, but everything seems to be fine. My head is killing me. Archer? Is he...
He's alive, Roxen, but barely. We bandaged up his skull, pushing a bone together, and sealed it with plastisalve. But I don't know. The axe entered his brain.
Maybe he can be helped at Ice City.
Don't strain yourself, Rock. Here, sip some of this fox meat broth. The Sasquatch just threw it aside. They preferred human meat. Robinson caught the fox just before we were captured. You've been unconscious for hours. I skinned it and cooked up a stew. We've all had some.
Oh, thanks. What was the total damage?
Everyone except Archer is okay. Of course, Robinson was.
I know. How far to Ice City?
I'm not sure.
Where's the map?
Under the blanket, near where your right hand is.
Rock groped around until he found the bundle, drew it out from under the blanket, and unrolled it in his lap. He quickly found the edge of the Sasquatch forest, and doing a little figuring based on McCoughlin's compass reading and the number of hours they had traveled, decided they were only 10 miles or so from Ice City. They sped through the snow-covered forest of dark, majestic evergreens with trunks as huge as the redwoods of California. It wasn't long till the party began traveling steadily upward. They must have gradually ascended a few thousand feet when the forest stopped abruptly, and they were on a plateau of snow and ice, entering a mist. They moved ahead, slowly, hardly able to see. Suddenly, the mist cleared, and the small band stared down at the most fantastic sight any of them had ever seen.
Behold! There is the Ice City!
Below them, built on a frozen lake that filled the mile-wide crater of a long-dead volcano, was a frost-covered city of spires and towers. All the buildings were made of ice. Over 100 buildings of every size, all shining like frosted glass. There was traffic along the winding streets. Great sleighs filled with people and pulled by horse-sized elks. Sleds of every size and description filled with furs, foods, clothes. All moving around the fabulous metropolis. At the far end of the crater, half up the lip, a spired castle rose like a diamond dream.
The Patala. That's what they call the palace. The king of the ice people, Yiglum, lives a life of luxury there.
Let's see if we can find help for Archer. Mush!
As they approached the main gate, Rock realized now that the city was not simply white. There was the palest of pastel colors to many of the buildings, glowing in the cracks of sun spilling through the clouds above. Brightly colored pennants waved from pale azure minarets, pastel pink spiral towers, and faintly golden turrets. The sleds rode down the main approach to the castle, between two white walls of snow. In the courtyard of the Patala, they were greeted by 10 white-garmented snow guards armed with spears. Though they seemed ready to fight, they didn't seem to expect it. It was more a show of power than a threat.
It is all right. They saw me in our sleds. They are friendly to my tribe. Now that they know who we are, we will be welcomed, fed, and treated as guests. It is as I said, Roxen. I did not steer you wrong.
Good, Tinglem. You did well. But tell them we have a seriously wounded man with us. Tell them I implore them to do anything they can for Archer.
Tinglem led one of the Ice City guards to Archer's sled.
What is wrong with him?
Rock lifted the hat placed over Archer's bandages.
Oh, my. You should rush this man to the Crystal Infirmary. Come, I will take him.
I will come with you. Roxen, you can go to the King's Palace and wait there for news.
No, I want to see this infirmary. The pal has to have the best of care. I'll come with you and Archer. The rest of you men, Sharansky, you too, follow these friends. Get some chow or whatever else they have to offer.
I suppose it would be good for your head to be checked out as well. It was quite a blow you took.
Yeah. I gave it right back to him, though.
That you did, Rock.
Tinglem and Roxen watched as the guards placed Archer gently on a stretcher, and then walked alongside as the men carried Archer to one of the side buildings in the palace courtyard. a single-story building of translucent pink ice that looked like a quartz crystal. Once inside, they found themselves under a vaulted ceiling, faced with a maze of corridors that seemed to glow of their own accord. They were led by an orderly to the operating theater, a pentagonal chamber of 30-odd feet in diameter, the center of which contained a table. The table was, as far as Roxanne could see, the only thing not made of ice. The guards were instructed to lay the wounded man upon the table by two shaven-head Eskimo men wearing pale blue uniforms. Each of these men wore an elaborate crystal necklace. Their authoritative and professional manner seemed to indicate that they were doctors of some sort. The doctors bent over Archer and placed the ends of the crystal necklaces against the wounded man's face and body at various points. The crystal necklaces seemed to come to life, sparkling and glowing with multicolored reflection.
This man is very ill. We do not know if we can save him, but it might be possible with the use of the crystal accumulator.
Do whatever it takes. This man has saved my life more times than I can count. I owe him this.
Very well. I'm turning on the accumulator now. You may hear a ringing. Do not be alarmed as the ceiling lowers. The crystals will start to glow. Those are the accumulators. They will tap into the Earth's magnetic sphere and channel that energy into Archer. It should speed the re-knitting of his tissues.
How long will it take? We're kind of in a hurry.
May take days, perhaps.
Days? Is there anything you can do to make this go faster?
This is not something you rush.
Does he need food? Or water?
No. The crystal accumulator will provide all sustenance. Come, we must leave now. We will soon turn the power to maximum, and it is dangerous to be around when it's at full power.
The beautiful crystal infirmary was to the Patala what a dime store gem is to a 35-carat diamond. The palace, though 20 stories high, had the appearance of lightness and the delicacy of a confection. It actually glowed. Its hundreds of delicately constructed Gothic spires were a pale pastel rainbow of color. The windows were filled with ice-stained glass, and the walls were so translucent that one could see figures moving about inside the hundreds of rooms.
Shall we go in? The king knows we are here, and it is best not to let him wait too long.
Rock motioned the others to follow them up the 16 ice steps and through the open doorway. White-robed men led them through the main hallway. The cathedral-like ceiling above was filled with gargoyles and demons carved from frozen ice. The floor beneath them was inlaid with marbled ice tiles. Delicate snowflake tapestries adorned the walls. Roxanne noticed it immediately when he came into the vast and cold audience room of the Ice King. The gloom. There were no smiles on the faces of the dozen or so court officials who lined up near the entrance to greet the strangers. The officials politely bowed, and Roxanne nodded his greetings to each of them, taking in the elaborate rainbow-dyed furs they wore with some amazement. A hush came over the great hall as the Ice King entered and strode down the royal ermine carpet to his carved ice throne. He was dressed in red velvet and wore a crown of quartz crystals, or diamonds. Rock couldn't tell which. The gems caught and refracted the light like prisms, scattering tiny spectra of light as he walked. The king turned and sat on his throne. His grim expression belied the sparkle of his jewels.
Visitors, come to me.
Roxanne, it is customary to kneel before the Ice King.
I don't bow to anybody, Tinglem.
But Roxanne, you know that...
It is fine, dear Tinglem. It does not matter right now.
Your Majesty, it is a great honor to meet you. I thank you for coming to my friend's aid. He would have surely died if it were not for your miraculous, crystal accumulator.
I am seeing you as a favor to Tinglem, Mr. Oxen. Tell me why you have come here.
Your Honor, we need supplies. More sleds, food, and an experienced guide or two that know the land to the north of here. We are on the trail of a killer, a beast who is intent on destroying the world. His name is Kilov. He has killed many of Tinglem's people and uncounted thousands of mine. And now he has a weapon that has the capability of annihilating any chance for freedom in the world. Will you help us?
I see. You wish to take more from us. Do you know why there are no banners here, Roxanne? Why there were no bugles to announce my arrival? Why my advisors are not by my side?
No, sir, I do not.
Because they're all looking for my son. At the age of 16, Roxanne, we of Ice City head out alone to the east to hunt the White Fox. It is a vision quest all young men must do as they come of age. He is days late in returning. So far, search parties have failed to locate him. He is my only son, Roxanne, the heir to the throne, and I fear I have sent him to his death. There will be nothing organized, no other party sent out, until my son is found.
But, Your Honor, you have no idea how important...
I have no idea? Do you know what it is like to lose a son, Roxanne? To wake up and face the future without him? 16 years, Roxanne. For 16 years I raised him, protected him from the harsh world. Perhaps I could have raised him better. Perhaps he would not have been lost. The answer is no, Roxanne.
But, sir,
my answer is final. This meeting is over.
So what's the plan, Roxanne?
For now, we eat. King was at least kind enough to feed us. We'd best take advantage. Hopefully, Tinglem can talk some sense into that king.
I can't believe the nerve of that man. Do you know what it is like, Roxanne? Boo-hoo-hoo. So his son got himself lost. What kind of damn fool tribe has kids wandering out in the snow?
We can't rule out that the son will come back, Roxanne.
But while we wait, Kilov gets further away. We can't wait too long, Roxanne.
I know. But how in the hell can we go on without supplies?
We can steal it.
Sharansky, we cannot insult our host.
Well, it's either that or we wait for Kilov to launch his missiles at whomever he pleases.
But what about Archer? Don't you think the king would take out his anger on him? As far as I understand, all they need to do to kill him is to pull the plug on the crystal thingamajig.
This is war, Detroit. A little triage is sometimes necessary.
You say that again, you red bastard. I dare
you. Do you Americans really value some dumb...
Roxanne!
Tinglem, what's wrong?
The king's son. They found him.
As king, it is my responsibility to inform you of this great tragedy. My son has been found in a cave far east from here. Murdered. Hanging. Mutilated. Our scouts found nothing. But these cigarette butts and a broken handle next to him.
Sharansky, that's Cyrillic writing on that handle, isn't it?
I think so, yes. It reads, property of Kagabwe. KGB, Roxanne.
Thanks, Sharansky. I think you just earned us our supplies.
Your Majesty!
Mr. Roxanne, I cannot begin to tell you how rude you are!
Your Majesty, that handle has Cyrillic writing on it. My men and I believe that it belongs to Kilov, the Russian that we have been chasing down.
This man, Kilov, has reason to commit this travesty?
His reasons make sense to him alone. In America, he was the head of the KGB forces. He thrives on dealing out pain and suffering. I have seen the excitement in his eyes when he talks of torture. There is no other man I would suspect as much as him.
Then this Kilov is the one who has killed my son? I want revenge! I pledge my support for your expedition, Roxanne. Under one condition.
What is that?
That you do your utmost to do away with this Kilov. Rid me of this monster that stalks my land.
I pledge to do so.
In addition, I want you to bring me evidence of his death.
What kind of evidence?
I want you to bring me this child defiler's head.
King, we don't do things like that. No matter how justified it may seem, if we commit mutilation, we are no better than Kilov.
I will be his head, Roxanne. Promise me this, or you do not get your supplies.
Very well.
Good. I will resupply you well, and send my most knowledgeable scouts with you.
The funeral procession occurred the next morning. It was like nothing Rock or his team had ever envisioned in their wildest dreams. The boy child of the king, in a nearly transparent ice coffin, was borne on the shoulders of the palace guard and carried down the main street. Candles were lit in the halls of every building and shone through the walls in the eternal northern twilight. The king's sleigh followed directly behind the ice prince's bier, pulled by immense elk. Behind the sleigh came the ladies and gentlemen of mourning, dressed entirely in black. Roxanne and his men, their heads bowed like the others, moved in procession behind the funeral cortege, four abreast down the main street. Just as the solemn candlelit procession reached the ice crypt in a nearby slope, a man stepped out from behind some boulders of colored ice. At first, Roxanne thought it was makeup, but as the procession closed on the crypt, Roxanne realized the man had some sort of ice-like skin of the palest blue. His eyes seemed sculpted out of ice.
Tinglin, who's that?
The most holy ice shaman. He officiates at all funerals.
The pallbearers laid the coffin at the shaman's feet. The king stepped down from his sleigh and stood next to the shaman. The rest of the assemblage grouped around the coffin. Roxanne watched as the man of ice threw some black and red particles on the coffin and mouthed some words. Then he turned and went back behind the ice boulders. The king could hardly contain his grief as the coffin carriers lowered the coffin into the crypt and slid the cover over it. All the candles and torches of the parade were extinguished, save one, which was to be carried back to the palace. One candle in every building was to be kept burning for the official 5 days of mourning. The funeral procession broke up and started back to the Ice City. Roxanne noticed dozens, hundreds of ice crypts scattered about the slope. He couldn't help thinking what would happen if a spring thaw ever came to these parts. But that wasn't his problem. Time was. In the near darkness, as he walked with Tinglum, Roxanne felt an unexpected icy hand on his shoulder. He steeled himself for battle and turned. But it was the ice priest. The man's blue face was close enough to feel his frosty breath.
I must speak to you, stranger.
I don't have the time.
Roxanne, I beg you not to be rude to the holy shaman. He has the king's ear like no one else. One word from him, and the king could be convinced to break his promise of supplies.
That is true, Nara. I ask you again, stranger, speak to me.
Fine. Tell the others I'll be with them shortly. Where are we going?
To my abode.
The ice shaman led Roxanne back behind the monstrous blue ice boulder from whence the man had come. Behind the boulder was a narrow entrance, and Roxanne had to stoop to follow the shaman into a large, dimly lit room. It was much like the king's own throne room. There the ice shaman took a seat and bid Roxanne to sit facing him in the Ice City equivalent of a Morris wing chair.
What do you want of me?
Tell me your mission.
We come from the United States. We free fighters fought to remove Kilov from power and free our country from oppression. We have succeeded in getting rid of Kilov and the KGB, but he escaped with 5 nuclear missiles. All other warheads are being shipped out of the States. We've been following his trail for weeks now, and are getting very close.
What does Kilov wish to do with these missiles?
He wants to use them to destroy the world.
So what if Kilov destroys the world? This would not be the first time such a thing has happened, Roxanne. Many civilizations have existed on this Earth. The last one to destroy itself with atomic weapons was Atlantis, over 9,000 years ago. They managed to sink their entire continent with the force of their nuclear bombs.
You say there really was an Atlantis? The oldest civilization I know of are the Sumerians. Everything that existed before that appears to have vanished, leaving no trace.
Not so, Roxanne. You see, the survivors of the Atlantean civilization found their way into the hollow part of the Earth. You can sometimes reach it through a tunnel that periodically opens at the exact location of the North Pole. There, gravity bends, and one can actually walk sideways quite a distance into the Earth. The survivors of Atlantis, in order to flee radioactivity, which was much greater by far than that caused by World War III, entered the underworld. There they stayed, living like cave bats for thousands of years, carefully maintaining much of their old knowledge. They emerged from the underworld to reclaim their planet, only to find that devolved mutations of their war ruled the land they had once claimed as their own. These devolved beings are the Sasquatch. The Atlanteans physically were no match for them, having grown weak from their safety underground. The Atlanteans had destroyed all their old weapons in their long stay under the Earth. They had become peaceful, but weak. But the surface was a fierce place. In the struggle to survive, the Atlanteans lost much of their knowledge. Do you know that we, the human race, the Eskimo and the Indians of the North, the Russians and the Americans, are all the great-great-grandchildren of those Atlanteans? And we have the same flaw. We are inventive. So inventive that we have had another war, for we were inventive without being mentally at peace.
Even if what you say is true, it's all the more reason for stopping Kilov. We've got to stop the use of any more weapons of mass destruction.
As long as mankind is not mentally at peace, there will always arise another Kilov, or Drubkin, or Hitler. My advice, Roxanne, is to understand that there is a time and a place for everything, and that everything happens at the right time. There are many examples in history.
But that's just it. There is no time. As we speak, Kilov is approaching his destination. Every precious second wasted brings us closer to mass destruction. I have to leave.
Before you leave, you must answer me this riddle.
What riddle?
A man who collects compasses lives in a square-shaped greenhouse. He has 1.5 wives with 4 arms and 2 red faces. His 2 children are alive, but her child, though living, is not living. The house has 5 red chimneys, and all 4 sides of the house face south. On a Tuesday in June, the man stares out of one of the house's 23 windows and sees a bear walk by. What color is the bear?
I don't care. How's he doing?
Your friend Archer has a remarkable constitution. His skull is healing nicely, but it will be many days yet before it will be safe to remove him from the crystal accumulator. It will be weeks before he is fully recovered.
Okay. I'll be back for you, buddy. You get better.
The extra supplies and sleds Roxanne had requested were provided by the Ice King as arranged. Roxanne, in the dim light of the winter sun, met the 3 new men that Tinglem had chosen to go along with them.
These men, Zeebok, Nagankook, and Dalmok, are expert hunters. When we run short of food, their harpoons will provide.
Roxanne nodded to the 3 men, who, like Tinglem, wore sealskin parkas. They were darker and shorter than Tinglem, barely 5 feet tall. The first one, Zeebok, was the shortest and darkest of the 3. His movements were quick and agile. Rock watched him move with interest. He hitched up his sled with great efficiency and speed. The one called Ngaikuk had a scar running the length of his face from the right of his forehead across his flat, wide nose and down to the left of his chin. He stared impassively at Roxanne, unmoving. The quiet type, as long as he's a good hunter and sledsman. The third one, Dalmok, was all smiles. His top 2 middle teeth were broken and yellow. This man appeared much older than the first, by about 20 years. His face was a mass of wrinkles, like a sun-baked prune. His black eyes seemed merry, and flitted about the group of free fighters. Roxen made sure the antimatter meter was secure on its sled, and he was about to move out when over a dozen shaven-headed acolytes toting spears came running up behind them. Roxen put his hand on his shot pistol handle, but hesitated in drawing it out when he saw the ice shaman come up behind the spear holders. The throng parted to let the Iceman through.
Why all the spears? You have insulted me by leaving my presence without my permission. I cannot let you leave Ice City until you make amends.
Rock eyed his free fighters. They had spread out and were ready to blast the spearmen and their ice guru to a bloody pulp.
What kind of amends? Either apologize by getting down on your knees and kissing my feet, or answer the riddle.
I don't kneel.
Then answer the riddle.
Repeat it.
Excellent choice. A man who collects compasses lives in a square-shaped green house. He has 1.5 wives with 4 arms and 2 red faces. His 2 children are alive, but her child, though living, is not living. The house has 5 red chimneys, and all 4 sides of the house face south. On a Tuesday in June, the man stares out of one of the house's 23 windows and sees a bear walk by. What color is the bear?
Roxen looked at the spear-toting acolytes. They were a mean-looking bunch who looked more like pirates than holy men. Shrunken heads hung from the center of their amber bead necklaces. Still, they had only spears, and Rock's men had their shot pistols strapped on as usual. Roxen gave the riddle some time, turning it around in his head.
Give up? If so, get on your knees and apologize, or you all die.
We're ready on your order. Don't bow down.
Kneel.
The color of the bear is white.
Excellent. You are quite right. Now, it is time for me and you to go. May the gods be with you on your journey, Roxen. Come, men.
The ice shaman walked hurriedly away, followed by his men. In a matter of moments, they had all disappeared from view.
Come on, let's get ready.
That was incredible. How did you know the barrel is white?
Easy. Any house having all 4 sides facing south must be at the North Pole. And if the house is at the North Pole, only a polar bear would be passing it.
But what about the rest of the riddle? The 1.5 wives, the child that is dead but isn't, all that stuff.
I think it was all there to obscure the single relevant fact in the riddle.
But why did he ask the riddle, Rock? Why did he threaten us? Is the shaman mad?
No, I think he was stalling for time. I think he intended us to wait. He wouldn't let us leave until the proper moment. He said something to me when we met before. His advice to me was to realize there is a time and place for everything, and that everything happens at the right time. He delayed us a few minutes for some reason.